All right, let's just. This is a weird episode so far. I feel like you're in a funk. We need to shake that off. I'm clearly overcompensating. Let's get into it.
Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. With me again is my co-host from San Diego, California, Keith Foster.
And with me, as always, is Cassidy Robinson from Los Angeles, California. Getting right to the intro, getting right into it, not fucking around this time.
We're doing that. Today we're going to be reviewing the Girl in the Spider's Web, a new dragon tattoo story.
Do we have to have that?
No, but I didn't know until I was just looking it up on IMDb that that's the full title of the movie.
Ugh.
Yeah. We will also be reviewing the Western 2017's Hostiles, which was in our Netflix homework that you assigned me last weekend. Do we want to just go straight into Obey Consume? Do you have anything fun?
Okay. So I have been finally tackling an old Grant Morrison comic book called The Invisibles. I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm.
I have a giant omnibus of it, and I've been meaning to read it for a long time, and I'm about halfway through that big son of a bitch.
Mm-hmm.
And it's daunting. It's like the size of a Grant Morrison book. Yeah.
And so is it weird as balls?
Oh, I think this is probably him at his weirdest and ballsest. but I'm totally digging it. I mean, it's very Grant Morrison in a lot of ways, but it's also one of his earlier comics. Mm-hmm. This is sort of one of the comics that made Grant Morrison Grant Morrison. Right. So it's like his Sandman.
Sure. So this is like right there in like the mid to late 80s, like right in the middle of like that British new wave of comic books.
Yeah, the British Invasion and the prime for Vertigo. And yeah. It lasted a lot longer than I realized, too. It went on, like, because I sort of remember seeing single issues in comic book shops when I was younger. It went on into the 90s and stuff. And it holds up. It's like, it doesn't even feel dated. Because mm-hmm. it's all about this group of heroes called the Invisibles. And they're sort of like, it's sort of Matrix-y in that they're like, fighting this underground war that most people aren't aware of. And they're like these secret freedom fighters. But it's a lot weirder than The Matrix. It's like if The Matrix was on fucking psychedelic acid, it's crazy. Okay.
So it's like the Animatrix.
I mean, it's not like they're...
That was a cheap joke.
Yeah. It's not like they're in a computer simulation. It's just like they are aware of the real world and a lot of conspiracy theory stuff.
Right.
And magic and black magic and hidden science. Like there's a arc where they have to break into this underground government installation to steal the secret cure for the HIV virus.
I see.
Yeah, but it like I said, it holds up surprisingly well because it's all about them fighting fascism and corrupt governments. And so I'm reading it, and I'm just like, Jesus, was this published last year?
Well, you know, the 80s, I'm assuming, is when this came out, right?
So I think it was late 80s, early 90s.
Okay, so this would have been late Thatcher and Reagan, possibly, or early Bush part one.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking.
So, you know, these things kind of go in cycles, unfortunately.
Yeah, it just, it's also pretty progressive for that time period, too. Like, one of the main characters is a badass drag queen, and she, you know, but she's like a powerful witch too. So it's just there's a weird arc where they have to go back in time to save the Marquis de Sade and like bring him to our time, San Francisco, and he's just like, I love it here. So it's, I mean, it's fun, it's silly, it's bonkers, but yeah, so that's my thing. I'm really into the Invisibles right now.
Cool. I started watching season 2 of Hip Hop Evolution on Netflix. I don't know if you caught season 1.
I haven't.
It's a documentary series done by a Canadian production company called Banger Films. They usually do a lot of like heavy metal stuff. They have a pretty popular channel on YouTube that I watch. But they produce a show called Hip Hop Evolution, which basically every episode kind of covers a different aspect of the history of hip-hop. So, you know, like the first few episodes cover like New York or like, you know, the beat poet stuff before it, the kind of underground like black poetry, slam poetry thing that sort of like led into hip-hop. And then like the, you know, the street scene and the DJing and the discos and all of that kind of stuff going through into modern day. But this season is going a little bit kind of like more into the nooks and crannies and the more sort of like, I guess, regional hip-hop scenes. So the first episode of the second season covers like the Dirty South, like Houston, the Ghetto Boys and Two Live Crew in Florida and like that kind of stuff. And then the second episode talked about the Bay Area. And then the last one I just watched, I was really happy about because I covered sort of what's my jam in the world of hip hop, sort of like the beginning of sort of like the Afrocentric, like conscious hip hop. So stuff like Tribe Called Quest and De La Soul and like all that hippie rap from the early 90s.
All right.
So it's a really cool series. I think it's really well done, very comprehensive. They get a lot of really cool interviews directly from the people who were there. You know, if they're still alive, then they're able to talk to them. But it's really well put together, just a really smart music documentary series, if you're into that kind of thing, which I am.
Yes, you definitely are.
So that's pretty much all I've been able to do as far as, you know, media outside of what we do for this podcast. Yeah,
let's go ahead. I'm growing a mustache for November.
Oh, fun. I think I saw that online, actually.
I'm not going to let it get as gnarly as the last time I had a mustache, which is the stuff of legend.
It was something.
It was impressive. You cannot deny that. But, so I've got that going on in my life.
All right, let's go ahead and get into our listener survey. We don't have movie news today. So I did post a survey earlier in the weekend, and I saw this on Twitter. This is usually where most of my questions come from. But it said, what is the most inappropriate film you saw theatrically when you were young, and how old were you? We got some ages here, not everybody posted their age, but Dave Lindsay has, he saw A Clockwork Orange when I was 17 in 1972 when it was released. Before that, I was in elementary school and there were basically no rules about what could not be seen or shown in previews. We saw some really wild stuff in trailers at the Saturday matinee. Yeah. Well,
before the days of like Red Band and Green Band and
trailers and that kind of stuff. Yeah. Clockwork Orange is, I mean, 17. I think that's about the age I was when I saw it.
I think so. Yeah.
Cause we were still in high school.
I think we were like 16 or something.
Maybe. Yeah, it wasn't too far from that.
It was around that time, yeah.
Yeah. And I feel like that's a movie that's very much a sort of rite of passage for a certain type of person. Like, if you're kind of arty, or you're kind of, like, into subversive stuff or whatever, if you're the type of person who, like, you know, reads for pleasure when you're a teenager, then at some point you're going to come across A Clockwork Orange.
Yeah, it demands more of its audience than, like, your typical popcorn flick, that's for sure.
Like, it is just a crazy-ass anarchistic experience. Brandon Hall, who we had on the podcast not too very long ago, said at 11 years old he saw RoboCop with a combination of the he's kind of describing the incident itself. He says it was a combination of, "Hey mister, will you say you're our dad?" to trick them into getting into the theater, and a justifiable eye rolling of teenage counter workers.
I mean, I was one of those teenage counter workers, and my rule was you had to not obviously be too young, and mm-hmm. you had to at least try. So, like, right. I wouldn't card people if they were just fucking cool about it. But, yeah. Like, the people who were obvious, if they came up and were like, "Oh, I'm not old enough, can I go in the movie?" No, like, you're not even old enough to try to fucking sneak in, you little bitch.
So, basically, if it was, like, 2 7-year-olds who were, like, one was sitting on the other one's shoulder, and they put, like, a trench coat.
I would give
and
them an award. Not only would I would fucking give them free popcorn, like... If two young kids had the fucking ball sack to do the shoulder on top of each other trench coat, man, oh man, I would have bought them beer.
you didn't even serve it, but you would go get it to give it to them.
Yeah, yeah. I'd be like, "You want a 6-pack of Natty Light?"
Melinda Jasmine Crouchley, probably didn't have to say the whole name, but that's how they have it here on Facebook. Terminator 2, I was definitely in elementary school, maybe 3rd or 4th grade, but I had already seen Terminator and all the Alien movies at home, so whatevs. Yeah, I saw that as a child, but I saw it on video, but I definitely saw it unedited.
Yeah, I didn't see it in theater. I was too young for that. But yeah. I think the first time I saw it, I probably did see it on, like, Fox or something. I don't know.
Oh, you saw it on TV?
Yeah, I actually the first time I probably did. But even still, like, they don't really edit the violence. They just cut out
just the swears. Yeah, and the scenes at the beginning when he's naked. There's some blurring.
Yeah, there's some clever editing, but it's it's like you still get a pretty good, you know. You still get the bleakness.
Yeah, you still get T-1000 shooting giant knives through people's faces.
Yeah, with the milk carton. Ugh.
Yeah. That's an image in my head forever.
The blood mixing with the milk. Yeah, it's like super fucked up.
Christopher Hull says something about Mary, and I was young enough to not get the hair gel joke. You know, something about Mary is kind of that's an interesting movie because it was such a phenomenon that nobody talks about anymore.
Yeah.
Maybe it was just because of that, like, let's outgross each other kind of thing. Like, the war of grossness, you know, was already battled for X amount of years after that movie. So that one just kind of got left in the dust. But, like,
And people took it a lot further, too. Like,
oh, yeah. Like, not even very long after that. It was just like, I will see your hair gel joke and raise
I will
you.
Spackle Anna Faris to the ceiling.
To the ceiling.
With semen.
Yeah. Exactly. But I don't know if people of a certain age can appreciate how buzzed about that movie was.
Yeah. Yeah. And nobody really talks about it anymore.
Yeah, like, that was, like, the, ooh, like, scandalous, like, dare each other to kind of see a movie, which nowadays you see it, and it's just, you know, it's kind of farcical or whatever, and there's a few semen jokes, but it doesn't go too far.
Yeah, yeah.
And then this last one, I'm not sure if it's a joke. David Bernstein says, Goonies, pure filth. Obviously, it's appropriate for children because it was made for children. But I will say, because it was made in the mid-80s, if you watch it now and it's been a long time since you've seen it, you might be shocked at, like, how much they were getting away with for kids.
Yeah, and I remember Sloth was really scary.
Sure.
At first and stuff, you know. So I think it just depends.
There's some dirt. I mean, there's like some of the stuff with Corey Feldman, like when he's like talking in Spanish and getting kind of blue with the,
I think it also
with the house cleaner.
On what age he saw it at.
Right.
Like, you know, if it's 4, then yeah, maybe that's a little too young. Probably.
Well, I'm seeing
like
a winky face here, so I think this is a joke. But
I think it's a joke too.
But there is some stuff. It's not the way a movie made for kids would be made now.
No, it's the way
Stranger Things would be made now, because it is.
Also, on Twitter, Patrick said, Die Hard, 7 years old, and RoboCop, also 7 years old.
Yeah, yeah.
I think those are pretty good sort of staples for our generation of seeing too young.
Yeah, well, we talk about this sometimes, but there's the weird phenomenon of the like late 80s and early 90s of hard R-rated movies that were marketed to kids.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they're, you know, movies like The Terminator, movies like RoboCop and Aliens and all of that stuff, which is just, like, people being eviscerated all over the place. And there are R-rated movies, ostensibly for people 17 or older, but you could buy their toys. And the same toy, right across from the Barbies.
Yeah, and there was a Saturday morning cartoon that was like... They just didn't kill anybody. It was like, we're going to catch you with our goofball lasers.
Yeah.
or all the bad guys are robots, usually.
That's usually the case, yeah. There was a kind of a wink and a nod from the movie industry. It's like, we know this is technically not for kids, but kids are going to watch the shit out of this.
Yeah.
And they definitely were kind of going for that.
What about you? What was the... was a movie you saw when you were...
Well, you know, it's kind of funny because I asked this question without having an answer. I just kind of threw it up and then I thought about it just a few minutes ago. And I was like, oh, shit, I never really even thought about if I have a good answer for this. I don't really. But, I mean, I'll say the one that came to mind because it was technically inappropriate or whatever. Mm-hmm. In sixth grade, I saw, and, you know, it was 1997, I saw Titanic with my parents as did everybody that year. I'm not saying...
PG-13.
It was PG-13, but there was some boobage. There was some boobage and a steamy, hot, you know...
We can do better.
Kate Winslet, Leonardo DiCaprio car sex scene. I'm not saying that is... That probably wasn't even, like, the most scandalous thing, because when I was very little, I was... You know, and I'm talking about like 4 and under, I was just dragged along to whatever movie they were going to. So I'm sure I was at R-rated movies or whatever with them at some point. But that's the only one where I felt kind of uncomfortable. And I was like, oh, this is weird.
Ooh, I've got that beat.
I'm sure you do.
Yeah, well, my parents did. I'm not going to say they didn't care, but they... They weren't super discriminate about it. Like, their thing was they didn't like really bad gore. I mean, they would give, you know, some action and violence a lot of lengths of rope. But if there was, like, guts coming out ever, like, they would try to avoid that stuff. Too much blood. It just kind of depended on the movie. But... I remember seeing this in theaters, Jean-Claude Van Damme's Time Cop.
Now, okay. You saw that in theaters?
Yeah. Okay. So, and it came out in 1994, so I would have been 9 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And there is, The movie itself, I don't think is that bad, because it's got, you know, it's got a lot of shooting scenes. It's got a lot of gun violence. But right. though I specifically remember a very awkward part at the beginning, because it's like the future. It's like when he comes out of the past the first time, back to the future to his cop precinct. And there is this other cop who is... has like a virtual headset on, and yeah. there's a very graphic virtual sex scene that is sort of out of context of the rest of the movie, because it's like a character that's pretty non-substantial. It feels definitely like they threw it in just to add a sex scene. It's
right, a, yeah, a gratuitous sex scene, as I would say.
Yeah, with full frontal nudity. And I'm sure it's not as long as I remember it being, but, you know, seeing that with my parents was just like, ugh, just, like, make this stop.
Anything that can neutralize a would-be hot sex scene in a movie is to have your parents present.
Yeah. No, yeah. Not only does it neutralize it, it's, like, a negative effect. It's just, like...
Yeah. It gives you, like, a reverse boner. It, like, goes inside your body.
Yeah. Turtle shell.
So that was our survey, and if people want to check our Facebook out, facebook.com/jabberpodcast, you can see when we have other questions like that posted. I usually post them around Friday or Saturday to get a couple responses before we record. Yeah, let's go ahead and talk about the girl in the spider web, comma, a new dragon tattoo story. Or no, sorry. Colon, a new dragon tattoo story. This is released just last weekend. It's directed by Fede Alvarez, which this is the reason why I had any kind of hope for this movie, is I like this director. He previously had done the Evil Dead remake, which I don't think is a great Evil Dead remake, but I do think is a cool horror movie if you don't try and think of it as an Evil Dead remake. I thought it had a lot of style. I thought that it was a... he was an interesting sort of aggressive new voice in horror movies. He did the movie Don't Breathe, which came out, I think, a couple years ago, which I liked a whole lot. And I thought was like a really cool, like reverse home invader thriller and a fun ride of a movie. And so when I saw that his name was attached to this, I was like, okay, well, we'll see what's going on here. So... this is sort of a conceptual sequel to the American remake of the Swedish thriller Girl with a Dragon Tattoo.
Which are all based off a book series.
Yes, yes. Stieg Larsson, a Swedish writer, and it follows a bisexual hacker goth chick, who gets into, you know, mysteries and crimes. And
I love how reductive your description of Lisbeth Salander was just then. I guess.
And her adventures with a fuddy-duddy journalist named Michael Blomkvist. And he, the last few movies, originally, and Noomi Rapace played her in the Swedish versions of the films, in David Fincher's remake, we had Rooney Mara played her in the previous film, the previous iteration, and now we have Claire Foy playing her here. In this version, we learn a little bit more about Lisbeth Salander's past, her twin sister, her abusive father, and... kind of goes from that into a flash forward to where we left off with her before, and there is some espionage shit going down where a scientist or a computer scientist played by Stephen Merchant has figured out a way to hack into nuclear missile silos, and, you know, whoever has this can, you know, take over the world essentially. And so there's a shady underground espionage spy ring that's trying to get control of this power. They call themselves the Spiders. And, you know, a lot of chase scenes. Like, about like half of this movie is a chase scene. Probably more than that, actually. I think like 60% of this movie is chase scene.
And also, Lakeith Stanfield plays an NSA agent who gets he's the guy who gets the program hacked from him. And so he's also sort of caught up in the middle of this because he's on her trail trying to get the program back, too. So there's multiple people hunting Lisbeth.
Multiple interested parties. Yeah. And actually, I don't know about you, but I feel like this movie would have been 90 times more entertaining if Lakeith Stanfield was the main character instead of Elizabeth Salander.
Well, I mean,
I'm not saying it would be a good Dragon Tattoo sequel, but it would have been a more entertaining movie.
I mean, he's definitely a more fun character to follow. He's, you know, a bit more charismatic. Lisbeth is, you know, pretty antisocial and keeps
most guarded and offish. Yeah.
Keeps most of her character interactions to like grunts or short bursts of only necessary communication type stuff. I do think it's kind of funny how the character Mikael Blomkvist through like the Swedish version to now is just getting like younger and sexier.
Yeah, younger and more attractive.
Yeah, I mean, he's played by Daniel Craig, who's at least older. And in this one, he's like, he looks like he's right out of college. He's like a baby boy.
He doesn't look that young. He looks like he's probably like edging 40.
He's a baby boy.
Yeah, he's definitely getting a lot prettier every movie.
Yeah, and the actor, I didn't think really brought anything interesting to the role either.
No, it took me a while to realize that that's who that was. Like, that's the character.
Yeah, like, I know. I'm like, oh.
From their first... Yeah, because the way they had always kind of, like, set that character dynamic up in both versions was, like, you know, she's, like, this cool, dark, interesting, you know, dangerous person, and he's, like, this kind of stuffed shirt journalist dude.
Yeah.
And it doesn't quite play the same here because he has this sort of like...
I think in, at least in the David Fincher version too, I think it's, the age is a significant factor to the character because there is like sort of this unspoken attraction, but she's very guarded around men, you know, for just reasons. And... You know, I think that there is a purpose to the fact that he's an older man.
There's a little bit of a father figure thing going on there, which this movie could have definitely tapped into more.
Like, a little confounded with. I was like, why is this character even in the movie? Except he's sort of a reverse damsel in distress, so that's kind of fun.
Yeah. I found very little of this movie to be all that fun, to tell you the truth. I don't think it's poorly made. Like, you know, as far as one of these kind of Jack Ryan Born Identity style things, it's okay for one of those. But if we're comparing it to either version of Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, and I haven't seen the Swedish sequels, The Girl Who Plays with Fire and Girl Who Kicked the Hornet's Nest. I have not seen those. But if we're comparing it to the Dragon Tattoo movies, it feels much less personal, much less emotionally grounded, and a lot more kind of stock genre stuff.
Yes. I'm gonna disagree with one thing you said, and that this movie isn't fun, because I feel like this movie is sort of only going for the fun stuff. Whereas, like, The Girl with Dragon Tattoo is actually trying to say some stuff, there's some subtext there about, about violence towards women and things like that. And this movie does not want to be bothered with that at all, which is interesting because I feel like this one could have been sort of the most personal story, but...
Right. I mean, especially we're opening it up to her past and, you know, all of this stuff.
But I do want to say...
It kind of hangs there.
I do want to say that I actually thought it was pretty fun, because at a certain point in this movie, the movie is like, I don't give a fuck. Elizabeth Salander is just a techromancer. Like, she can hack into any computer with a fucking cell phone. Like, it takes hacking to the point of being like an elemental power. It's similar to Dominic Toretto's power over vehicles.
Yeah, right.
he's a car elemental and she's a technomancer, and I want to see them team up so bad. So, like, I think as far as the genre stuff goes, it's working pretty well, because I think there's some pretty good action set pieces. There's some pretty
fun, set pieces are good. Yeah,
there's some pretty fun chase scenes. There are some moments, though, and this really bothers me, because when you have a character like Lisbeth Salander, when you have characters that are supposed to be like sort of, they're so intelligent that it's almost like a superpower, and then you have them do very dumb things, that gets very frustrating to me. So there were some set pieces, not set pieces, but there were some like small action sequences that relied on certain characters being stupid, and I hate that.
Yeah, there was also, at the same time, there was also a lot of sequences or a lot of set pieces that only functioned because of extreme conveniences.
Yes, like, that's what I mean. So there was some stuff where I felt like some of those sequences could have been plotted out a little bit better, so that they're not just like, oh, that happens to be there. And that was about when I was like, oh, okay, I'm not going to get anything else out of
substantive
this movie.
Out of it.
Yeah, I'm.
You just decide to turn your brain off.
Exactly. I'm like, okay, I'm here for the action. I'm here for this to be sort of a female James Bond. And I think...
And that's pretty much what it is. And I think that, you know, if you're just watching it on that level, like I said, if you're comparing it to, like, one of the lesser Bourne movies or something, it's fine. I just had a hard time caring about a goddamn thing. And so whenever there wasn't an action sequence, I was pretty bored. And I have to say, most of the acting, not bad per se, but everyone's kind of acting on the same sort of like flatline, dry, cold delivery, which I get is supposed to, like, you know, go with the whole like Swedish frozen environment.
That works for Lisbeth in a world filled with not Lisbeth.
Yeah, I get what they're going for. Like, Fincher kind of set the tone, I think, and definitely Fede Alvarez watched that movie and was taking visual and tonal cues from it. But I feel like there's a certain sort of romance that Fincher brings to the screen that he can do cold and interior and you know, guarded and all of that stuff, and still pull the inherent drama somewhere out of the performances or out of the, you know, production design or whatever. This movie doesn't really do that. It just kind of does those things.
There were a few,
and there are a lot. They seem a lot more external.
There were a few people that stood out to me. I'm a fan of Claire Foy, and I thought she did pretty good, considering she had maybe 12 lines of dialogue
throughout the movie. I like her physicality. And I think she could have been good in the movie. I just don't think she has anything to do.
Yeah, exactly. I think she did sort of her best. I think she did pretty good at certain points of, you know, showing us there's this internal struggle. So I appreciated her performance. I really liked Lakeith Stanfield. He's a lot of fun. Yeah. And I really liked her hacker friend who plays Ed Kemper in Manhunter.
Sure.
He's a pretty good actor.
I liked him. Like, that's the thing, is I kind of liked everybody more. Like, if I'm thinking about it as, like, how can I junk this vehicle for parts? I'm looking at all of the other performances and like, ah, I like that character a lot more. There's almost like, there's a scene where like,
nah, dude, when she fucking hacks through a fucking airport security with a cell phone, I'm like, I'm all in, Lizbeth. I'm all in.
Yeah. Those sequences are entertaining. The many car chase scenes, although I do think they tend to fill out the plot because there's not much going on really.
I think
that those are all functionally fun and easy to follow, and I think that Fede Alvarez has a good eye for action sequences, and I like some of the fluid camera work, and it has a cool steely look to the movie, but it's so cold and distant that it feels ephemeral. I just can't.
I'm going to chop it up into a couple things. I think there's some major script issues going on, and
yes.
On that note, I want to propose something. Are all child actors as bad as we think, or are or writers just really bad at writing children characters?
I think the latter. And yeah, this is the second magical autistic child we've had recently.
That's true. That is true. I mean, they didn't literally come out and say that his autism was a super brain for predators to feast on, but
no. Instead, his brain was held the nuclear codes.
Oh my god! And that was so fucking predictable too. So I think there's some major script issues going on, and I also think that there's some editing issues going on because early on, I noticed. Okay, so this is getting real deep in the weeds, but follow me on this. I saw the initial trailer, right?
Sure.
Which the initial trailer sort of shows that cold open moment where she ties that husband up and saves that woman.
Oh, right. At the very beginning. It's like, if you like Lisbeth Salander torturing guys, get ready.
Well, yeah. So they show that. And I noticed a difference in pacing from the trailer and the movie. In the trailer,
it's kind of like a trailer.
No, it was paced way better. They actually drew that scene out and gave it time to build tension. And then when I was watching it in the movie, I was like, why is this like moving 50% faster than when I saw it in the trailer? I bet if you watched the trailer and that scene in the movie like back to back.
Yeah.
The trailer is longer and actually lets that scene breathe more and actually builds some tension into it. So I was like, in the movie, I was like, why is this not as good? I remember seeing the trailer and being like, oh yeah, this looks dope. And then in the movie, I was like, that felt really weird and flat and forced. So I think there's some weird editing stuff going on too that I think probably cut some, I think this movie feels like it, like somebody, some producer was like, cut around the bullshit. More car chases.
Maybe there's like more story stuff that got left on the floor. Because it felt like to me, like they were like, well, we don't want to do the other two sequels that they already did in Sweden. So let's just kind of use the first American remake as a jumping off point. And I felt like to me that the people who wrote this or the people who put it together didn't really understand the appeal of Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. And they're just like, I don't know. She's like a spy or something, right? Like, we'll just have some shit with like nuclear codes. That's in all spy movies. And then we'll have some cool, like sleek car chases. And at some point there'll be like this, a chase sequence or a sneaking around sleuthy kind of thing in a airport, because that's in every spy movie.
Yeah, and exactly.
That's what I meant. Just like everything in this movie is so stock.
I mean, she's literally going after nuclear codes, like
right.
Okay,
and the final conclusion with the villain is like just like we've seen in every James Bond movie.
I looked it up, and actually, it is the same characters, but it was a different author.
Right.
So it is the same character, same universe, but yeah, it's not
Stieg Larsson.
It was David Lagercrantz. So Maybe that had something to do
with it. Screenplay. Yeah, so I don't know. I don't hate this movie. I think if you happen to catch it, on TV later, it's fine. But
I think this is a great, like, TNT in a hotel room, Sunday afternoon, don't have anything to do kind of thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, I don't think anyone needs to, like, rush out to theaters to see it. But I also think it's not as bad as some of the critics have kind of been saying. I think a lot of... I think if you're holding it to the standard of Dragon Tattoo, you're going to be disappointed. But if you go into it knowing it's just kind of a fluffy piece of genre pulp, then it's fine.
Yeah, I guess. I'm a little less enthusiastic about it, just because,
bitch.
There's just nothing here that I haven't seen somewhere better. I mean, even for the stuff that it's doing, which is pretty stock.
Yeah, I would agree.
Skyfall is better. Some of the Bourne movies do a lot of this better.
I would say GoldenEye is better.
Yeah. So generally speaking, meh. This is like a C average for me.
I think I gave it a C+. Was what I was gonna give it.
Yeah.
It's fine. Worse ways to spend a Sunday afternoon.
All right. Well, let's do the Netflix homework, Hostiles, and I'll let you set that up.
Okay. So Hostiles is about Christian Bale is playing this army captain in the Old West, probably mm-hmm. like late 1800s. He's a bit of a racist and a curmudgeon. You know, in his character at that time was mostly hunting Native Americans and
right.
Killing, like aggressive Native American tribes and stuff like that. And he's stuck with this military duty. There is a chief who is in custody of the federal government, who's dying of cancer, and the federal government grants his release back onto his land, him and his family, before he dies. And so Christian Bale is this captain who's assigned to escort him back home through hostile territory. Yeah, so that's basically the setup. Really violent, racist man. And, will he sort of turn on the natives, or will he do his duty and take them home?
Right. Rosamund Pike shows up at some point in this movie as well, as sort of this
mother who's like slaughtered by particularly
the Comanche
group, and their crew stumbles upon her and sort of takes her after her entire family's killed and takes her along for the ride.
Yeah. This was written and directed by Scott Cooper, who previously had done the movies Out of the Furnace and the Whitey Bulger thing with Johnny Depp. Black Mass, that's right. Before that, he did the movie Crazy Heart, which was the movie that gave Jeff Bridges his first Oscar? Well, he gave him an Oscar. And, with the exception of Crazy Heart, which is, about a world-weary country music star who's, like, dealing with addiction and, his autumn years of life, the other films, Out of the Furnace and Black Mass and this, seem to kind of function similarly in that, as a director, as a writer, Scott Cooper is kind of fascinated with the tragedy of violence. Whereas, he kind of takes on these sort of genres we've seen before. Black Mass is a gangster film, and Out of the Furnace is sort of a noir. This film, Hostiles, is a Western, but he instead of glorifying the violence or finding some sort of catharsis in it, like most movies of these genres do, he sort of dwells on it, saying something more about the inherent contradictions of human morality.
Yeah,
and these kinds of things.
I haven't seen his other movies, but speaking for this movie, it's definitely, you know, like how that can weigh on someone
Post-traumatic stress disorder is a phrase that's never uttered in the film because it wasn't a thing at the time. Mm-hmm. But that's definitely a theme that runs throughout.
For sure, yeah.
You know, everybody's going through some sort of trauma of their past. Rosamund Pike more directly and more recently, mm-hmm. because we see her family killed, you know, the first scene of the movie. You know, everybody is dealing with either coming out of the Civil War or they're coming out of, like, Wounded Knee, and all of these, you know, American tragedies. And I think that that's what the movie's kind of saying in a larger thematic scale is, you know, our blood-soaked soil and the tragedy of violence that we created this country in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so that's his postmodern take on the Western that he does here. Structurally, the movie reminded me a lot of The Searchers. Because, you know, it's a bunch of guys going off, you know, trying to accomplish this thing, and they kind of go on this, you know, existential odyssey.
But I mean, Westerns without shots like that, are they even Westerns?
Yeah, I mean, the famous door frame shot that we see in every movie after The Searchers.
Yeah.
And, you know, the classic shootouts and that kind of stuff.
And also kind of the, I think it's kind of similar to The Searchers, too, in the fact that it's John Wayne cast as this cowboy, and it's a little more like, well, you know, what is this cowboy life, you know, really like? It's more of
questioning.
Yeah, challenging the convention of the heroism of that kind of character. So I think there's some thematic similarities to The Searchers as well.
For sure. And probably intentionally so.
Yeah. I would weird to think that...
Scott Cooper is kind of hit or miss with me. I liked Crazy Heart a lot, for what it was, kind of a small movie, but I thought a good movie. I thought Out of the Furnace was okay. Black Mass, I thought was kind of a hot mess. This I thought was probably one of his strongest films. And I think that this thing that he's working out on film, this you know, this theme of American violence and what it means to our society and blah blah blah, I think really fits well in the Western milieu, more so than what I've seen in his previous movies. And I think that he kind of finds a balance with that tone. I think the characters interact in more interesting ways. I like you know, the way the movie looks, very darkly lit, as a lot of his movies are, but and there's a lot of really distinguished, decent performances all throughout. I mean, you know, besides just Christian Bale and Rosamund Pike, who are both good, but also, you know, Rory Cochran and Ben Foster shows up and acts weird for a little bit and
does his Ben Foster thing.
Yeah. But to good effect.
I feel like Ben Foster might just be a creepy, like, old cowboy who found a time machine. And they keep putting him in movies to play weirdos. And he's like, I don't know about your motion pictures, but I can pretend to be another person. I agree with everything you're saying. I mean, this isn't like a fun cowboy movie. This isn't like True Grit or something like that. It weighs pretty heavy on you, I think.
Sure.
But I like the way it unfolds. I was afraid it was going to get a little too sentimental on me.
Yeah, I was a little worried about that too.
And the but I think the way the character arc plays out is pretty understated and cool.
Yeah.
There's not this one moment that's just sort of makes the character change or whatever. It's sort of a slow evolution, and I really appreciated that.
Yeah, and I think that that Scott Cooper does a really good job at using other characters as a foil to our protagonist, and he's able to sort of judge himself, you know, around these other people. Specifically, Ben Foster, I think, plays a big role in his character arc as being sort of his almost a personification of his shadow self or his mm-hmm. id yeah. or something like that, or, you know, his worst racist qualities.
Yeah, like when he showed up, that was sort of the moment when I was like, oh, okay. Like, I get what's going on here. You know right. what I mean? But not in a overly on the nose way. Yeah, yeah, it was, I think it was pretty well done.
Yeah, and it's done very classically, and, you know. If my only complaint is it's a tad long. It's a 2:15, and I think 15 minutes could be shaved off this movie pretty easily. There's a lot of scenes, a lot of speechifying mm-hmm. going on in this. Like, everybody kind of has these, like, actory moments where they're, you know, kind of like on the screen. You could tell it was just kind of like made for like award season or something, and which is weird because it came out to like no clamor. I didn't even hear about this movie. I didn't remember hearing about it like in theater, like, or having any kind of lead up or anything like that. And considering, you know, this director and this cast, you think there would have been more, but and so there's a little bit of just ponderous scenes of people just kind of talking and crying and that kind of stuff. And I think some of that is necessary, but maybe not as much as we got.
Yeah.
It feels a little self-indulgent sometimes, specifically with the performances, but
it walks a line for sure. There, like, I kept sort of waiting for this movie to sort of drop the other shoe on me. Like, mm-hmm. I kept expecting it to sort of go in ways I didn't like. Like, it sort of kept setting itself up, like you said, to be the sort of pandering thing.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of that is, like, you're right. It felt like it was kind of going for, you know, prestige award season stuff. And yeah. And I sort of kept waiting for it to disappoint me because of that, but it would always just sort of come back from that precipice.
Yeah. And I think the reason why is because this is, it's more complicated than that. Like, I think Cooper did a good job at, like, never making that line black and white, and never, for sure. like, coming up with an easy answer. Like, everything is, you know, there's interesting discussions here about race, and there's interesting discussions here about violence, and there's interesting discussions
but it's never
about,
like,
PTSD.
But it's never like, through this journey, your racism's cured.
Everybody's, right, exactly.
Yeah. And that was what I was expecting, was like these moments of like, now everybody's friends. Mm-hmm. You know, and I mean, that doesn't mean the character doesn't change and evolve and get away from that. But yeah, it does do it in more interesting ways, more subtle ways.
Yeah. It's still kind of messy. Like, there's not everything's tied up. And there's still things about the character definitely is imperfect, and other characters as well. So I think in that way, it kind of keeps it from, you know, being too sentimental. But I think that might be the reason why the movie didn't catch on, too. But I think because the movie is a little fussy, I think that, especially around what is normally sort of predictable genre, that might be the reason why this movie didn't find an audience upon its initial release. And generally speaking, Westerns are just not super marketable.
Not right now. And it's not like a fun shoot 'em up either. So I think it is a little harder to. I think it would have been pretty hard to market this movie now if this movie had been made in like 2008 or even earlier.
Yeah.
Maybe it would have had some legs to stand on. Like if this had come out the same year as even further back, if this had come out the same year as like Gangs of New York,
sure.
I think it would have been a little bit more of the cultural conversation. But as of, 2017, I think a movie like this is just really hard to get people to see.
Right. And it asks a lot of the audience, paying attention and picking up on the themes and that kind of stuff. And
sitting through a 2-hour-plus movie. I watched this movie on an airplane.
Yeah. See, that I wanted to talk to you about that because to me, I'm already super tense on an airplane and I can barely, keep focus on a podcast or something like that. I'm just trying to, get through the experience as quick as possible. Anything like this,
Are you people, afraid of flying?
I'm not a fan. Anything like this, whether it's people getting murdered and all this kind of stuff, I don't know if I could deal.
See, I think it would have been a lot harder for me to watch this not on an airplane because I know it has a 2-hour-plus runtime. Mm-hmm. And so I'm counting hours. I'm like, oh, okay, by the time this gets done, I'll have a half hour left and then we'll land or whatever. So especially where it's cowboys, has nothing to do with airplanes. It's pretty easy for me to not think about the fact that I'm 30,000 feet in the air or whatever. I didn't bother me. Although I do get a little weird watching rated R movies.
Right, because the people behind you, they're going to be like, what the fuck is he watching?
Yeah, is that fucking Christian
when someone's
Bale
getting scalped on screen. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But I also don't give a fuck. I'm like, well, don't watch my screen if it offends you,
Right.
Honestly, the biggest problem I had with it was that it is so dark. And I don't mean that in terms of content. I mean that in terms of actual lighting, and there are a lot of dark
scenes. Oh, you mean literal?
Yeah. And so if I sat at a certain angle, it was kind of hard to see everything just because, those airplane movie screens aren't the best.
This is meant to be seen on a big screen. This is a big wide frame, vistas and low lit lighting and that kind of stuff. This was meant for the theater.
And the audio on the speakers, because the speakers I had weren't the best either. So especially
you didn't have headphones?
No, I had headphones, but again, sound quality. This isn't Dolby Digital. So those were all the problems I had watching this movie on an airplane were purely technical.
It's not a fun Western. It's not a romping, rollicking adventure. It is dark and violent and, it's asking a lot of the audience, but I think it's kind of worth it. I'm grading on a curve, this is definitely one of the better projects from this director who I think is kind of hit or miss.
Again, I haven't seen a lot of his other I don't think I've seen any of his other movies. I was surprised how much I found myself enjoying this. But you know me, I'm a Christian Bale fan. It was just I got more out of it than I was expecting to. But I do feel like you kind of have to be in the right mindset. You have to be patient with this movie.
Yeah.
I don't know that I'll ever need to watch it again.
Right.
It's not super fun, but I think it's got some really good stuff to say, especially on the subject of race and racism is a foundation of America. That's worth hearing.
Yeah, worth talking about. All right. Well, next week for our Netflix homework, I'm going to get into a little bit of Noirvember, and we're going to review...
God damn you. I'm not letting that slide.
It's a thing. It's a thing. It's a hashtag. It's a movement. It's a thing. I didn't just make that up right now.
I feel like maybe it's better seen written out than hearing you say it.
In celebration of Noirvember, we are going to be reviewing Orson Welles' 1958 film, Touch of Evil, which is on my list of shame. I've never seen it. Stars Orson Welles in the lead and Janet Leigh from Psycho. But yeah, this is one of his bigger movies that people talk about, you know, outside of Citizen Kane and, you know, whatever else.
All right.
So we have to get sad for a little bit. Over the, I think it happened yesterday, actually.
On Veterans Day, when you're listening to this. Monday, Veterans Day.
Stan Lee, creator of Marvel Comics and many of the characters that we know and love, many of which are in the Avengers, Spider-Man, Fantastic Four.
Co-creator.
Co-creator, yeah. A big mover and shaker in the early Marvel days. Recently died. He was 95 years old. He kept on trucking all the way up to the end. He did a cameo in all the recent Marvel movies from the first Spider-Man up till now. He was just in a small part in, you know, a cameo in the Venom movie. It's the last thing I saw him in.
I guess they pre-filmed a lot of his cameos for the next few movies too. So we're going to see him a few more times, but not many. Yeah, I mean, God, Stan Lee, he's one of those people that just, like, it feels like he's been old forever.
Right.
So, it's like, it is shocking that he's actually gone now. And he's one of the last, like, remnants from the golden age of comics, too. And certainly one of the most prolific, like, I think he does... I mean, I love Stan Lee. He's nerd, you know, nerd royalty. I think he gets a lot of credit, which a lot of the stuff he worked on, you know, was collaborations and stuff. But I think something that's not really talked about was he was a salesman. You know, not only did he help create these characters, but he really helped market them and make them the iconic characters that they are, and he wrote a lot of them. You know, like he co-created them with a lot of artists, but he wrote a lot of these, you know, iconic origin stories, Stan Lee, I think one of his biggest claims to fame as far as the comic book world goes is he was really good at making the characters relatable. It wasn't just enough to have, you know, a crazy man with spider powers, but let's see the Spider-Man when he's just an awkward teenager in school, too. He was one of the first people to really push sort of the humanity of the characters and making them relatable. So, this is... You know, he was 95. He hasn't written or created anything in a long time, but his presence was, you know, felt.
Yeah, for sure.
Like I said,
and he was still very much a notable figure in the world of pop culture. Like he was always. I mean, there was Stan Lee's Comic Con, which is still going to this day. He was always there. He'd usually do a few panels at that up to last year. He was probably there this year. I don't know.
I know the last couple of years were kind of rough for him, actually, because he did, he was in a retirement home. His wife passed away either last year or the year before. I don't think it was terribly surprising. He was 95, but it's
yeah.
Just,
I mean, that's a long run.
He's such a legend that it's hard to think of the comic book world without Stan Lee in it now.
Mm-hmm. For sure. Yeah. You know, I mean, still the world of actual comic books, like the ones that you buy in a store and read in their paper. That's still a kind of a niche industry, but it is the comic book universe as a whole has become, you know, all encompassing in pop culture. But there was a point of time where this stuff was more than a niche. I mean, it was like kids and then like, you know, closet nerds, and that was it.
Yeah, I mean, I remember, you know, there was a point in time when I was younger when I was a little embarrassed that I liked comics and superheroes and that I watched, you know, the Saturday morning cartoons. And now it's like, you know, you see memes. It's like, if you remember watching this, you had an awesome childhood. And I'm like, yeah, but I also remember a point in time when I felt weird about liking that stuff because I was supposed to be into football. And that's something Stan Lee and comic books, you know, I think that a younger generation doesn't know that that wasn't mainstream. That wasn't popular culture. That was like, yeah, it was considered like kid stuff. But, you know, it's, I love that it's not anymore because comic books and cartoons and a lot of the stuff Stan Lee created was hugely influential on my life. And I think another thing about Stan Lee that's really important is his stories, he wanted to have a moral quality to them. Mm-hmm. It wasn't just enough to be entertaining genre pulp. He wanted them to have some kind of a message, some kind of a morality, some kind of a, you know, the good guys were good people and the bad guys were bad people. And you know, I think it's easy to look back on some of that stuff and think, well, it's a little reductive now. But at the time, it was like, I don't know, he was one of a kind.
Yeah. He will be missed. But that's the episode. If anybody has anything to say about anything we talked about on this episode, you can email us at jabberonthedrone@gmail.com. You can follow us at facebook.com/jabberpodcast. You can follow us on Twitter at jabberpodcast and on Instagram at jabberpodcast. You can follow me individually at VC Cassidy on Twitter. And you can stream and listen to our show at Stitcher Radio, iTunes, Pocket Cast, the Windows Podcast Network, Player.fm, and Google Play.
You can follow me at Keith Foster Kid on all the anti-social media. Am I right? Check out my website, www.keithfosterkid.com. I've been trying to keep it more updated with shows that have been going on. Check out, I've been performing a lot more at Old Town Improv Company. Check out their website, www.oldtownimprov.com, for show dates. I still do book club, different improvised genre every month. Our schedule's getting a little weird just with the holidays coming up, so we might only be doing one show a month instead of our normal two. And then I just had my other show that I started, Alt Comedia. It's an alternative comedy show. So it's like stand-up, sketch, character stand-up. Kind of just anything comedians want to do that's just a little bit different than what you could do in a, you know, in a two-item minimum club. We had our first show of that, and it went really well. I was very happy with it. The theater liked it, so I think we're going to try to do another one every month, so we should have another one coming up hopefully sometime in the first couple weeks of December. So again, check out my website for that. Check out oldtownimprov.com.
All right, cool. Be sure to check out our other friends out there who are doing their own podcasts, including Patrick and Dennis are coming back with Almost Educational. They put out an announcement. They have an episode, I think, that's supposed to drop here pretty soon. So keep your eyes peeled on that. That puts the pressure, though, on Rod over there at the listening party. you know, he has a few more weeks to either announce or to post something, and he's no longer going to be mentioned at the end of this podcast.
Oh, shit. Rob, get your shit together.
Officially pod-faded. Also, check out Bill and Brian over at the Great Albums podcast. They just released an episode this week about No Doubt's 1994 classic Tragic Kingdom. And it's a really good episode, and I think a great jumping on point if nobody's hasn't checked that out yet. Check out Mike Falick over at Hack Thought and Buddy and Alice over at Those Happy Places.
Yeah, and check out our friends, the Adamant Podcast with Adam Connie and Campfire Shit Show with Marilyn Bow.
All right, and that's the episode.
Excelsior! Bye, true believers.